Good evening. I'm grateful to be recovered from sex and love addiction. My name's Rob Cayley. Well, I wasn't nervous till I got up here. I want to first say thank you to the local planning committee for inviting me to speak. I'm truly honored at the recognition, at the trust. And, you know, 15 years ago, something like this is something nobody would have trusted me with. I would have quickly and easily, if possible, led you astray. I come here honestly. My sobriety date is January 8th, 1995. My first sobriety date is January 18th, 1992. It's taken me 14 years to get 11. And I haven't, in the meetings that I've been in at this convention, I haven't heard people state their sobriety dates, but in 98, I did some work in Dallas for a period of time. And I know in AA, they would state their sobriety dates at the beginning of the of their share, pretty much everybody. And they would say, well, you better state your sobriety or you might lose it. And so I just want to offer that to you, that of what my sobriety date is, so you know where I'm coming from, what my experience is. I was listening to some stories throughout the week. I've been here all week and listening to some stories of some people throughout the week. And I heard a story of a woman who, if she wanted out of the car at 70 miles an hour, would grab the gear shift and just start moving the gear shift and drop a transmission out of a car more than once in her addiction. I heard a story of a woman who, to get attention out of her boyfriend, would hit herself in the head with a hammer. And I heard a story of a woman who, to threaten someone else to leave her man alone, would use power tools on the phone. Some of these stories you may know. Some of them are on CD. You'll probably hear them if you stay around long enough. And I just don't know if I really belong here, because I'm just not quite that bad. Yeah, I know. I'll get over the denial someday. I was born in Denver, Colorado. I come from Tampa, Florida. I was born in Denver, Colorado, and when I was 6 years old, my family moved to Florida, and we moved on the east coast of Florida near the Space Center. And we all loved Colorado, and we all hated Florida, but we've never gotten out of there. So, and I just trust that it is what it is, and it's what's supposed to be. And I've come to learn that from you over the past few years in recovery. The reason that I mentioned where I was raised on the east coast of Florida, it was near the Kennedy Space Center, and some of you from Houston may be able to relate to this, because I grew up in the space era in the 1960s and the 1970s, and most of the people in the area worked at the Space Center. And so it was, come from a military family and you lived in a military environment, it's kind of like that people might be somewhere for 2 years and then they'd transfer, because with the space program, they might have to transfer from Florida to Houston or to Denver or to Seattle or wherever it might be. And so I did not have those long-term friendships that I saw on TV that I thought people were supposed to have. Because people were, you know, there for 2 years and then they were gone. They might be back, you might never see them again. And so I felt different and unique. I was not Mr. Popular. I was not the most athletic. I got threatened to be beat up and even beat up a couple times growing up. And I just felt different, unique. I felt like I didn't fit in. And I needed a solution to that. I was restless, irritable, and discontented, and I just didn't think anybody understood. And I don't know the exact age, but somewhere along 12, 13, 14, I got introduced to sex. And I got introduced to that actually in the Boy Scouts. And I was absolutely interested in it. And what it did for me is it made me feel like I belonged. Because if you would do this with me, I must be okay. Now, I've been looking for it for longer than that, because I can remember, we moved to Florida when I was 6, and I can remember when I was 6 years old trying to get the little boy next door, who was a couple years younger than me, to urinate in the ditch so I could see him naked, so I could see his business. I'll just say it that way. I don't know of any incest. I don't know of any child abuse in my history. This is mine. It was my desire. It was my interest. Now, along in those teenage years, also the same thing happened when I got introduced to drugs and when I got introduced to alcohol. I finally felt like I fit in. I finally felt like I was like the rest of the world. I've heard it said by an AA speaker at an AA convention, the difference between, and I'll say in addict terms, the difference between an addict and a non-addict is a non-addict feels okay and like they fit in, and then they drink, drug, act out, and they feel restless, irritable, and discontented. But I start out restless, irritable, and discontented, and then when I drink, drug, or act out, I feel like I fit in. No wonder they don't, and I do what we do. Drugs, alcohol, sex, relationships, that was my solution. It wasn't a problem. It was my solution. I thought I'd found the magic answer to all my problems. At 16, I was already out in bars. The drinking age in Florida at that time was 18. At 16, I was already out in bars. The bar owners knew I was underage. It was understood that if they came and said, come with me now, I was not to question or whatever, that there was probably something legal going on and they would get me out of there. So they didn't get in trouble, probably more than so I didn't get in trouble. At 16, I had a lover who was 32. I thought I was on top of the world. By the time I was 18, then I could start going out and venturing out to other bars that they could card me and I could get in anywhere. And I went up to Daytona and they had flashy lights and a lot more activity than the area where I grew up. And I just really had arrived. This continued on for many, many years. Thank you. This continued on for many, many years. I added various different forms of acting out into it. And what I did is I turned my will and my life over to the care and direction of a power greater than myself. I turned my will and my life over to the care and direction of sex and love addiction, as well as drug and alcohol addiction. I'm going to focus on sex and love addiction, but just know that this other stuff was going on too. And it worked. I got what I wanted. I got the excitement. I loved the chaos. I got the happiness. I thought I was on top of the world. I got attention from people. I felt powerful. But each time it paid off a little less. And a little less, and a little less. Tell you a few stories, because I don't want to go on with a big acting out. You know what that is. You know what that's like. I want to try and get to some recovery for you. I want to also not sit up here for a long time. We're already behind schedule, and we got a lot this evening, so I want to try and get to some recovery stuff for you. and hopefully offer some hope. Just know when I say that I qualify to be here, trust me, I qualify to be here. I'll allude to it in a little bit. But some funny stories. One story, I was asleep in a parking lot of a bar in Orlando. No car around me. When I finally came to, went back in and started looking for more alcohol and sex. Relationship-wise, I didn't have a lot of relationships because I did a lot of sexual acting out. And what I now know is that was part of the avoidance part, the anorexia part, that it was a perfect, safe relationship of an anonymous sexual liaison, that I wasn't vulnerable. You couldn't hurt me. We had this little relationship. The relationship was over. We both understood it was done when it was done. And move on, next relationship. Now serving number 32. Number 32, please step up. It truly was that bad. I did have one relationship, and this was in about 83, 84. And the first time I met this guy, he was, I met him at a bar. He was a total asshole to me. I thought it was love. He was engaged to marry a woman, and this had to be love. So I didn't meet him for a period of time. We didn't do anything that night. I was just acquainted and introduced to acknowledging who he was. And we met again at some period of months later, and finally got together, and it was love. And we were together, and I was telling a story the other night in the hospitality suite as we were trading war stories. And at that time, you know, what my addiction did to me is all this time, even into my 20s and close to my 30s, I couldn't afford to support myself. At 18 years old, my dad got me a job doing the same thing that he was doing, making the same money he was making, but I couldn't afford to buy a car. I couldn't afford an apartment. I lived at my parents' house, you know, because I had an addiction to support. You know, I had better things to do with my money than to buy a car or a house or, you know, any of that. So I get in this relationship, and it was funny because I'm living at my parents' house, and so I've got the phone cord drug into my room, and we're having a conversation, and it's a fight, and he hangs up on me, and I walk out in the hallway, and my parents are like, you know, as far as not any further than these chairs over here, watching TV, and he's hung up on me, and I go out and click the phone, dial his number, and he answers, and I say something and slam the phone down on him and walk off back in the bedroom, and then the phone rings, and I go back and pick it up and answer and go back in the bedroom, and a few minutes later, he hangs up on me, and, you know, I mean, my poor parents are sitting there going, okay, this was my relationship. And I can remember the thoughts that, you know, if I can keep this relationship, maybe I can be acceptable in society because then I won't be out there doing these other things. That I kind of had a thought that society didn't think I should be doing. And I felt like I was doing more than what society thought I should be doing. And so maybe I could fit in. So the relationship was going to be my solution. Now, I'll reference one thing before that, an acknowledgement of my powerlessness. Sometime in the early 80s, because that relationship started in 83, sometime in the early 80s, I was working with a woman, and it's when HIV and AIDS first came about, and it was the gay plague. And we didn't know what was causing this. And there was no opportunity for a cure or any solution to it. And I remember having a conversation with this woman, and I hadn't seen step one on any wall anywhere, hadn't been in any recovery room, hadn't read any book. But I remember this conversation with this woman, and I said, I will not live to be 30 years old. Because I knew I could not stop what I was doing. It did not matter that it would kill me. inconsequential. I must do this. I can't stop. I'm glad to tell you and grateful to tell you that I celebrated my 48th birthday about 6 weeks ago. Part of that's this program, but some power carried me through before I got to this program, because everybody that I knew, everybody I was having sex with, everybody that I dated died in the mid to late 80s. And I didn't get here until the early 90s, till 92. So there's some reason of something I'm supposed to do here. I wish I knew what it was so we could be done. But I just keep showing up. I just keep showing up. So I understood powerlessness. And there was another example that I think back of in the late 80s of having these conversations in my head with no one around. I know none of you do that. And have these conversations with my nieces and nephew about sex and drugs and alcohol, and to try and keep them from getting involved in any of them. Because I knew once I started doing those things, I couldn't stop. And in hopes that, you know, I might be able to have this, and it's grandiose in my head, of course, but that, you know, with good reason, to have a conversation with these family members, these people growing up in their early teenage years, that, you know, that you're playing with fire once you start opening up these doors that we open up. That was a statement of powerlessness to myself that I didn't know. And I still had not seen step one yet. Still hadn't been in a room and heard any of you share yet. So 1991, as you may have determined by the few short stories that I've told you, I wanted what I couldn't have. I wanted the straight guy. I wanted the hustler. I wanted somebody who was in a relationship. If they were available, go away. And so in 1991, carrying out one of those patterns, and I was intoxicated at the time, I ended up propositioning what I thought was a hustler who turned out to be a 15-year-old boy. And there happened to be a cop behind me, and I was arrested for lewd act in the presence of a minor. And I'm on those websites today as a result of that. And I don't always like that, but I have to live with that. And what I can tell you is I have a relationship with a higher power through you all on the 12 steps as a result of that I wouldn't have otherwise. I don't like it. I don't like the consequences of it. I don't like the hassles of it. And I don't like the fear that comes up, but it's there. And it makes me work a program because I don't get a choice. The information's out there. And I've been taken care of. I haven't truly had any consequences other than just having to deal with the legal system. And I just keep doing what I'm supposed to do. And that's all I can do. It's all I know how to do. And it's worked so far. And I have nothing to believe but that it will continue to work. There was one other story I was going to tell, and I can't think of it right now, so I guess you don't get to hear it. We'll see if it comes back. So I came into, well, in 1991, I was arrested. My court date was coming up in February 92, so I rushed to the lawyer's office and the counseling program he told me to go to 6 months later. And so I show up at this counseling program for the appointment that I'd made in December and January of 1992, and go in for their intake. And the lawyers told me, well, you were intoxicated. That's actually a legal defense. We get you into this counseling program. That'll be a legal defense, blah, 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 blah. So I go in and I do this intake for an hour telling the truth. And let me tell you what, that wasn't me willing to tell the truth. I don't know where that willingness came from, if there's not some sort of a God somewhere. Because Rob didn't tell the truth. I didn't tell everything to everybody. I didn't tell everything to anybody at that time. I thought I was out of the closet. I wasn't. The story I was going to tell you was just that I'm focusing on relationships with men. There were also times that I had sex with women, too. They were few and far between. But, you know, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. Give me what I want. And so I'm in this intake, in the counseling, and I tell the truth for this hour about what's going on in my life. And where that willingness came from is just, it amazes me to this day. And he finishes the intake, and the counselor gets up, you know, tells me to wait, and he gets up, and he's gone for way too long, and comes back with another man who's the director of the program. And the man says, well, he says, we've got a counseling program for you here that'll fit right in. He says, you're an alcoholic. And my jaw hit the floor. And I said, I picked my jaw up off the floor, and I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm gay. We just don't have as much responsibility as the rest of you guys. He gave me that smile, you know, the one we know. Like, that's nice. He hands me an AA meeting list and he says, here's the gay meeting. You will go to two meetings before the counseling session on Monday, and you will go to two meetings every week, or you won't be in the counseling session. Now I need this counseling session for my legal defense. So I go to a meeting. So I pull up in front of the meeting house the night I go to this meeting, and it's the gay and lesbian meeting, of course. And naturally, they're going to be more than happy to see me because I'm so wonderful. And don't you love newcomers? And I pull up, and here's one of my drinking buddies' trucks in front of me that we used to set in. Sitting on the street in front of where I park, and he and I used to shoot pool and, you know, run around together. We tried sex once or twice. That wasn't anything. So we just, you know, drank and shot pool and chased other boys. And here's his truck. And so I'm like, so this is where Todd's been. I've wondered. I haven't seen him in a while. So I go in and I start going to AA meetings. And, you know, you know that thing about don't get in a relationship for the first year? That doesn't apply to me. I'm not quite as bad as the rest of you. So I get in a relationship with a guy who's been sober about a week longer than me. Now, as insane and humorous as that is to us now, let me tell you what, that saved my life. Because he was an alcoholic and he needed to be in meetings, and so I was in meetings to protect his little ass. And he was an alcoholic and he needed to have a sponsor, so I got a sponsor to support him getting a sponsor. And he was at a, so I did a, so blah, blah, you know the story. And 6 months later, the relationship ended, and I stayed sober. He stayed sober for a year that time. I've heard that he's gotten sober since by not going to gay meetings. And I hope that he has found sobriety. I hope he has found the gifts that are in here. So I get this sponsor. She's this lesbian. And I'm at the gay and lesbian, you know, AA meeting house. And she, you know, I know I've got to get this sponsor to support him because he needs to get a sponsor. And one night before the meeting, you know, I've been maybe coming for like a week, week and a half, and she's like, hi, how you doing? I was thinking about you today. And I was like, really? wow, you know, I know this isn't about sex because it's, you know, the gay and lesbian environment. It's like, that just astounded me that somebody was concerned with me. So that and a couple other things, you know, real important things to qualify a sponsor by, like she was left-handed, I'm left-handed. My parents' house number is 917. Her sobriety date is September 17th. You know, important things. These are what I chose my sponsor by. I suggest you put a lot of effort into it. So I asked her to sponsor me, and she says, absolutely, no problem. I said, well, there's something you need to know before you say yes. And she says, what's that? And I took her out to my truck, and I showed her the arrest report, and she read the arrest report. And mind you, this is AA, not SLA. She read the arrest report, and she finished reading it, and she said, you know, did you do it? And I said, yes, I did. And she says, okay, fine. She says, call me every day. If you get my voicemail, or my, it was an answering machine for her, if you get my answering machine, leave a message, and we'll get together once a week, and we'll go through the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sitting there going, no lecture? No judgment? Okay, I can do that. And so I started working the program with her. She didn't say we were going to work the steps. She said we were going to read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wanted to work the steps because I wanted to get to that resentment thing because there were a lot of assholes in the world. So we're going through the book, and I think I had one of those assholes cross my path before I got to the fourth step, and I wanted to talk about resentment. She says, pray for him. Let's get back to this point in the book. And so we went through the steps. And you know, I talked about all this stuff with her. I just talked about everything. Now, along that counseling, you know, is outpatient once a week, Monday nights. And in that group, after that group, probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks sober from drugs and alcohol. Because, see, I'm not an alcoholic, so not drinking is not a problem for me. So I'm doing this just to take care of what I need to. But this counseling program and this guy in the group, we're talking in the parking lot afterwards, and he has this phone list that he hands me, and he's talking to me about this and where I can get support. And it says SAA and SLAA phone list. And it's got these lists of all these men's names and all these phone numbers. And I said, what's SAA and SLAA? And he said, Sex Addicts Anonymous and Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And a light went off. And I said, I don't know if I need Alcoholics Anonymous, but I need to be there. I knew I needed to be there. And he also told me some of these men on this phone list were straight. So that was kind of intriguing that I might get to go to a meeting and listen to some stories from some straight men. So I went. And there were about 25 or 30 men in there. And we went around the room and everybody shared. And I shared when it came to my turn. And, you know, I related and I belonged. And I don't remember if it was that first night, if it was 3 meetings later, if it was 2 months later, but, you know, I wasn't there to listen as a voyeur anymore. I was there to recover. It just happened. I didn't have to come here with good intentions. I just had to show up. So that meeting that was 25 to 30 people within 3 or 4 weeks was down to 3 people. And I didn't know what I had done to chase you all away. Truly. Truly. I didn't tell anybody that, but I truly believe that. I don't know what I did, you know. And within a month or so, I'm carrying the key to the bag, you know, the key in the bag to the room. And I'm one of a few people in the room. And it wasn't a men's meeting. It was mostly men in the room, but it was a mixed meeting. And there was this woman who started going to the meetings. And she'd been sober in AA for 10 or 11 years. And she's going to SLAA, SAA meetings now. And she'd share it. And I mean, she was sick. She was crazy. So one evening meeting, she's sharing about that she needs to get a sponsor in this room in the S groups. And this must have been a couple of months along because I was already sponsoring people. This must have been at least 6 months along. And so the meeting ends, and she starts walking my way, and I'm going, God, no, no, no. And she comes up and says, will you sponsor me? Now, I've already been told that when the program asks, you have to say yes. And I'm like, fuck. So I said yes. And I'm so glad I did. Because I got to see what someone going through the steps who was crazier than a bedbug. So crazy she couldn't drive at night. She couldn't drive on the interstate. She couldn't function in society. I don't know how she'd lived. And I saw her do the steps and do the actions that, you know, and I'm new. I'm not any guru. I just did what I was taught to do, what was done with me. And I saw her change. And I knew the power of these steps. I knew not only what it had done in my life, but I knew what it had done in hers. And what it had done in hers was bigger than what it had done in mine, in my eyes. And so I knew the power of the steps. Now, another thing that happened during that time period, I came in and I got sober. That relationship also gave me sobriety because I just stayed focused in the relationship and I wasn't going out doing the other things and I was going to meetings. And let me tell you what, I didn't do 90 and 90. I probably did 180 and 90. And if you think you can do a meeting a week, good luck. I couldn't. And I encourage you to do much more than that, to do a meeting a day, every day. 90 and 90 is not three for one day and skip two. It's a meeting a day. I know how you think. I have that same mind. So I'm doing these meetings. I'm listening to tapes. I was doing outside sales. I didn't listen to the radio. I listened to recovery tapes all day long. I'd listen 15 minutes in between, you know, from this call to that call. And, you know, I'm doing therapy, and I'm doing SLA meetings, and I'm doing AA meetings, and I'm working with my sponsor, and, you know, 6 months along, start working with sponsees. And I couldn't have stayed sober without that. And I know I couldn't have stayed sober without that. I couldn't have done it on just going to a meeting a week. This was too big. I had already turned over my life to a higher power, sex and love addiction, drug addiction, alcohol addiction. I didn't have control of my life. So I didn't have any choice over what was happening with my life. So I had to turn my life over to recovery. And by going through the steps, I found a relationship with a higher power. And when I use the word God, when I talk about a higher power, I use the word God. Our basic text uses the word God over and over again. And when I say that, to me, it's not any of those religious connotations of a God. I don't know what it is. I just know it is. And that's all I've needed. I know what it's not. It's not me. And that's been enough, and that's worked. So I got sober when I first started, and I worked the program, and I'm listening to all these people relapse, and they're resentful at me because I'm not relapsing. And I'm resentful at them because they're out having fun. Insanity, but, you know, that was my perception. And, you know, I felt like I didn't fit in, but I kept coming back. I kept showing up. I had the key to the room. I had the bag. I had to be there. Thank God I had to be there. Because if I'd had a choice, I might not have gone. And I experienced a year of sobriety. And the night that I was going on a Tuesday night to pick up my one-year medallion, I was 1 year and 3 days sober. And I've worked the steps. I'm working with sponsees, taking them through the steps and talking with my sponsor. We've opened up the possibility of me maybe dating, and she's fine with it. And at that time, I still smoked cigarettes, and I stopped at this store to buy a pack of cigarettes, and I come out of the store, and it's in a gay-friendly area in Orlando, and there's this guy walking up the street, and, you know, we know each other, you know. I'd met him before, but you know how it is. We see each other, and we know. And so I waited while he went in the store and made myself busy, and then I was still out there in my truck when he came out. And he came over to my truck and, you know, introduced ourselves, and I said, you know, would you like to go out sometime? And I truly meant to go out, dinner, movie, coffee, you know, get something, a date. And he says, sure, my apartment's right up the street. You want to come over? And this voice in my head goes, no! And I said, okay. So I went up to his apartment, and I literally sat there realizing I could not make myself stand up and walk out of the room. I was powerless. And we did what we did. And once we'd finished, I left and called my sponsor. Not before, after. Call my sponsor. She wouldn't tell me. Called Todd, this friend. He wouldn't tell me. Nobody would tell me whether I was sober or not. My sponsor says, do an inventory on it. So I do this inventory, and it's like, I don't like this answer. Now, I'd gotten enough information on this guy that he was going, when we left his place, he was going to work. And so I go to work to try and justify in this in my mind that maybe this can move into some sort of dating relationship, and, you know, I can save my sobriety somehow. You know, and he's in a relationship. Well, is it a good relationship? Is it going to end anytime soon? Nothing worked. So I went to the meeting that night, and I did not pick up my one-year medallion. And I shared about acting out. And for quite a while, I used the phrase, I lost my sobriety. And words are important. I'm careful in choosing what words I use. And I now don't use the word lost. What I can tell you is that year and 3 days is always going to be a part of my experience and my sobriety, and it can never be lost. Yes, I did interrupt that period, but I will never lose that year and 3 days, because I need to acknowledge that I didn't do what I'd been doing for a year and 3 days. I stopped doing what I couldn't stop doing for a year and 3 days. That's pretty damn big. Now, you and I know I didn't stop doing it, but you understand what I'm saying. So thus started a period where I get sober for a while, act out, get sober, act out. Didn't like that. I'm Mr. Bigwig in the meetings. Remember, I'm the one with the bag and the key. So I start lying and saying that I'm sober now when I'm not, and that doesn't work either. I just remembered something that I didn't remember till right now. But one of the sponsees that I had at that time, that I had to go back and say, I've been lying. I've been acting out. I'm sitting in this room. That's powerful. What I can tell you about that period for the next couple of years of acting out is I didn't feel like it fit in. People would come into SLA meetings and they'd talk about incest and being molested, and I didn't have that. And I spent a lot of time trying to find what wasn't there so that I could fit in with you. And so I ask you, if that's part of your experience, to honor that and take it to the fellowship where it belongs, but it doesn't belong to all of us, so let us form on our commonality and our addiction and what we're doing, not what was done to us. Because it made it hard for me to be there for a long time, listening to other people tell how they were victimized. And I don't want to take anything away from what happened to anybody, but it made it hard for me to get sober. That doesn't mean I couldn't get sober, and I'm not putting the responsibility on anybody but me for me to quit. But I just want to tell you how that affected me. Now, I'd been sober. I knew how to do the deal. And so when I finally got to the point, and I had to go through another arrest, by the way, which violated my probation. There's a God story in that I'll tell real quick. I violated the probation. The probation that I'd gotten, we'd had an arrangement for 2 years probation, adjudication withheld on the first charge. We went before the judge. The judge was one of the hard-ass judges. And, you know, prosecution was agreed to 2 years. We'd agreed to 2 years, presented to the judge. The judge says, no, 10 years. So I get arrested again during this relapse period, have to go back in front of this judge for violating that probation. And my probation officer and my lawyer are there, and they don't really say anything to me until afterwards, but they were obviously, you know, he could have thrown me in jail for the rest of that 8.5 years. And we went before the judge, and almost without any testimony, without anybody telling anything, the judge says, fine, I adjudicate you guilty on the original charge, violate that probation, give you a new probation of 8.5 years. And all it did, besides adding the adjudication of guilty onto my record, all it did was added 3 days onto my probation. And we walked out of there, and my lawyer and my probation officer said, what just happened? And I said, don't worry about it. I know what happened. Now, I was still struggling to be sober, but I was still in the rooms. I was still doing the deal. And the message that I want to give you is, if you're struggling, keep coming back, or just stay. It's easier than coming back. But don't go out. Don't leave. Don't quit coming. So in late 1994, I decided, okay, fine, I'm going to get sober. I decided my sobriety date. I decided I wasn't going to act out anymore after January 8th, 1995. And I put into place the things that I know, and I started doing what I needed to do. And it talks about in the withdrawal pamphlet in here, or the withdrawal chapter in here of the basic text, it talks about, first of all, the acting out has to quit, but then it goes on to talk, if you read a few pages later, about those accessory behaviors. And I knew that if I stayed away from those accessory behaviors, I stayed further away from that edge. And the further away I stayed from that edge, the less likely I was to slip off. And I started doing that one day at a time. And it was that simple, and that was my part. And I kept working the steps, and I kept working with sponsees, and I kept praying. Now, and that's the sobriety date that I shared with you at the beginning of the meeting, January 8th, 1995. And the January 8th, the reason I picked that date, it matches my AA sobriety date, just the difference in years. But both dates are January 8th, and alcohol and drugs is 92, and SLAA is 95. Now, I want to tell some God stories, because I didn't do this, and God has let me know that she's been in my life the whole way through. Now, that first relationship that I started in ended at 6 months, so this is between 1 and 6 months in the program, and I'm in meetings, and it's like, okay, you're supposed to, you know, pray at night and pray in the morning, you know. Ask God to keep you sober. Thank God for keeping you sober. And so one night I'm in bed, and I'm trying to say my prayer. And I can't focus on the prayer. And I said, God, help me focus on the prayer. Now, this is going on in my mind. It's the same voice, but listen to the difference in the pronoun. And this is exactly what I heard. I said, God, I can't focus on the prayer. Help me focus on the prayer. Get out of bed and get on your knees. Well, can't I just do it here in bed? Get out of bed and get on your knees. But Tim's going to wonder what I'm doing. Get out of bed and get on your knees. Well, can't I just like laying on my stomach and pull my knees up underneath me? Get out of bed and get on your knees. So I get out of bed and I get on my knees. And Tim says, what are you doing, baby? I said, I'm praying. He says, oh, okay. And he gets up and he goes in the bathroom. And so I do my prayer. Focus on it. No interruptions. No distractions. Finish my prayer. Open my eyes. Didn't even hear him come out of the bathroom. He's on his knees beside me praying. Got it. A couple of years along, we used to go to the IHOP and eat afterwards. And one night, and this is after an AA meeting one night, and we were in this IHOP, and there's five or six of us there. And this would have been after October 93, because in October 93, I put down nicotine and caffeine. And so I had ordered a Sprite, because Sprite doesn't have caffeine. And the waitress brought a Coke. And I said, no, I ordered a Sprite. And she says, I'd swear I heard you say a Coke. And I said, no, I don't think so. And she says, okay. And she left it on the table, and she walked away. And she comes back with a Sprite. And a few minutes later, this guy comes up, who none of us have ever seen before, and says, are you guys from the meeting? We said, yeah. He says, can I join you? I said, sure, sit down. He says, can I have a Coke? Yes, sir. So he visits with us, drinks the Coke, walks outside, and he's standing outside no further than here to the you know, one of the front tables in distance, but he's outside, the window's between us, and he's standing at the bus stop waiting on the bus. And we're sitting there talking, and it's we almost all at the same time said, you know, we haven't done all we're supposed to do. We just all knew it. We all felt it. And at that time, the waitress appeared, and we said, let's order him some food. And somebody else says, I'll go out and get him. And at that point, you'd see him turn around and start walking back in. Nobody's talked to him. So he comes in and sits down, and we said, we've ordered you some food. And he says, thanks, I haven't eaten. And he ate the food. And when we all left, I dropped him off at a halfway house, and I haven't seen him since. I have no doubt that God sent me, sent us, not me. See that ego? Me, sent me. I have no doubt that God sent us somebody who needed some help and said, take care of this person, help them. If you work this program, you work these steps, it will really, really, really screw up being an asshole. So part of my amends, besides making direct amends, is I spend a couple hours on Saturday listening to my parents. Did it today, and that was fine. I can do that. And so in 2001, would have been in February 2001, in one of those conversations with my parents, we had a disagreement over something, and I can be really mean and nasty with the absence of words as much as I can be with words, and I just gave the silent treatment. And you know, we finally finished the silent phone call after the longest time. And so I go on with my day, and I continue to feel worse and worse and worse as the day goes on. So by the time it's 7 or 8 o'clock at night, I'm in a meeting that I normally go to, and at the end of the meeting, I can't wait to go talk to this woman that I want to go talk to and say, with tears streaming down my face, say, how can I make amends and apologize to them without letting go of my point? And she says, just go call and apologize and say, can we start over? And I said, okay. And so I drive home. Driving home, I want to commit suicide. I want to drive the car into a bridge. I want to go drink. I want to drug. I want to act out. Anything to get out of that feeling. And I get home and I pick up the phone. And I don't call my parents. I call my sponsor. And tell her the situation. Say, how can I apologize without letting go of being right, basically, without letting go of my point? And he says, call him up and apologize and say, can we start over? And I'm like, you've been talking to this lady? So I call, and my parents get on the phone, and I say, you know, I apologize. I don't want to hurt you. Can we start over? And then this woman took over my mother's body and says, you know, I can understand why you feel the way you feel. Okay. The 10th step is during the day, because I don't know if I'd have made it till that night to do a 10th step. If you follow the big book for the directions on the steps, the 11th step is the evening inventory. Look it up. Prove me wrong. Now, the story doesn't end there. And I think I was given that pain from God for a reason. Pain motivates me. Motivates me to action. It made me make amends. So the next weekend, part of the argument was over things that were going to happen the next weekend when I go over to my parents. And the next weekend, I go over to my parents. And I arrive, and my nieces and nephew inform me that my mother's fallen and hurt her shoulder, and my dad and she have gone to the hospital in an ambulance. And my sister's gone, and, you know, phone communication, they get back, and my mother's broken her collarbone. My mother does not deal with pain very well. What do you want to know who the only one was that could do anything right for her? The reason we were all going over there is there was going to be about 15 family members. My dad's sister was coming down from Ohio. And do you know who put dinner on the table? And it was fine. I had no problem doing it. My sister begged me to stay. I said no. I've learned to say no. But it doesn't end there. And that was February. In April, my mom calls and says, your dad's in the hospital. And we thought he had internal bleeding or something going on. He hadn't been looking good. And it's just like, okay, I'll be over there. You know, he's okay. Oh, yeah, they downplay everything. Oh, yeah, he's okay. And so then another day or two, you know, I was going to go over on the weekend, and another day or two, it's on a Friday morning, and I call the hospital to talk to my dad, and he's drugged up. And I said, what's going on? He says, they just did a bone marrow test on me. This doesn't fit any of the things we've been talking about. I said, okay. And I hung up the phone, and I called my mom, and I said, did you know they just did a bone marrow on Dad? And he says, I don't remember if she knew or not, but she's like, don't worry about it. Just come over tonight after work. Don't take off work early. I'm like, I'm coming over. I went to my boss and I said, I've got to go, and I've got to go now. Because I didn't know what it was. So I go over, and what we ended up finding out by Sunday is he had, we did not find out. We did not find out yet. But we knew it was something big. And so on Sunday afternoon, you know, after visiting all weekend and so on, I went back home. We knew that what he was looking forward to probably wasn't going to be easy. And on Monday night, near midnight, my phone rings. And he's passed away. And the verdict came back on the following Thursday, the day we buried him, that he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that Monday night, when he had passed away, he had gotten up to go to the bathroom, and his heart just quit working. And he was in the hospital. They had him on monitors. They came up, came in, worked on him, got nothing. And what that did for me and my family is that it let us know that, first of all, he was there to have the medical attention. Second of all, that there was nothing there. There was no response when they tried to bring him back. That let us know that he was supposed to go. I have no doubt that God came and said, you don't have to go through this anymore. Come on. And I was able to show up and be there for my family. And I only had one argument with my mother during that week that we buried my dad. Now, the real gift is, a few months later, in talking to my mother, I said, you know, I think I cleaned everything up because of the steps, because I'd gone back and direct amends and everything and what have you. And I said, I think I've cleaned everything up. Do you know of anything? And she says, no, the slate was clean. If I hadn't found recovery, that wouldn't be the case. That slate would not be clean. And I would have to sit here and try and live with the guilt and live with what I've done. Please do those amends so that you can live with the result, even if they don't deserve the amend. Do the amend for yourself. Now let me wrap up with telling you my last relationship story. This was in 1999, and I don't very seldom go out to a bar, but I happened to go out to a bar this one night, and we met in a bar. And I'm like, no, we're not going to have sex. And he's like, why not? And so for 6 months, you know, I tell him about being arrested, telling him about being in recovery, you know, telling him about all this stuff. And it's like, no, we can't have sex. And he's like, well, I wish I'd met you before all of this so we could have sex. I'm like, no, you don't. So it's 6 months into the relationship, we finally introduced that into the relationship. And he's not any good in bed. You want to know what recovery did? It didn't matter. Did not matter. I didn't care. And I never would have thought I could have said that. But it didn't matter. It was of no consequence. That relationship probably would exist today, except he needed to do work on himself, and he wasn't able to account for his side of the street. And I am not spiritually strong enough to be in a relationship with someone who can't take up their side of the street. Now, if you talk to him, he'd tell you what an asshole I am because I gave up on the relationship, because I ended the relationship. In that relationship, I'm the sex and love addict. He's the one that went out on me, not me on him. When I was in an ABM in Houston, because I took my boots and I might go out two-stepping, and he thought if I went two-stepping, I'd go home with somebody. Like I'd have any time to even go out two-stepping in an ABM. But I, you know, I was a dreamer. I hoped I might be able to go. But I wasn't calling him often enough from this retreat center that had one phone and I have no cell phone, you know, just all this crap. But the beauty of that was when I got home, I knew something was wrong. I knew something was wrong before I got home. And when it came out, I wasn't mad. It wasn't about me. It did not hurt me. It was like talking to a sponsee. And he's like, but you took your boots. And I was like, no. Even if I did all that stuff, you're still the one who did what you did. Even if I'd done all that stuff, it's not justification for you doing what you did. Two wrongs don't make a right. And I didn't do anything wrong. You don't get to put it on me and blame it on me that you went out and screwed around. The relationship went downhill from there, and it finally broke up in a counselor's office. I insisted we had to go to couples counseling, or I was leaving, and that just bought 3 more months and clarity for me that it was the right thing for it to break up. And it broke up in the counselor's office, and I'll just jump to the fact that we did counseling on Friday mornings, and he knew what meeting I'd be at on Friday nights, and, you know, broke up with him in the counselor's office. I said to the counselor, who actually had been a previous sponsor of mine, I said, you know, is there any part of this that's mine? And he smiles, shakes his head, I was like, oh, fuck. What is it? And he says, selection. So it's Friday night after this breakup that same day, and he, this guy that I'd broken up with, you know, comes to the meeting where I'm at, and he says, can we talk? And I'm like, sure. And so we go over in the parking lot, and he says, I've been thinking all day, and he says, I don't want to break up. And he says, I was wrong. Now, on the outside, I look like, on the inside, I'm like, and he finishes that I was wrong with, I didn't wait long enough for you to change. Got it. Can we get back together? I said, no. And I had to spend 2 to 3 more months with him coming back saying, can we get back together? And saying, no. And I said, no. And that's because of this program, you guys, and him, or her, whatever. I don't like to give God a lot of credit because my ego doesn't get the credit then. But you know, this is not a self-help program. If it was a self-help program, we wouldn't have step one. Step one is, I can't help myself. It's not a self-help program. I must have a power greater than me and greater than my disease, or I'm screwed. And the rest of the steps lead me to that. Please work the steps if you haven't already. If you have already, keep working them. Don't listen to that bullshit that I tell myself. I already know what I'm going to find out in this. I don't need to do it again because I always find something new. Work with a sponsor. Work with a step. Work the steps. Work on a relationship with some sort of a higher power. The steps don't tell you what to believe. They just tell you what to do. Don't act out one day at a time. And quit worrying about all the details, and it'll all work out. It's all being resolved. Thank you. I do want to read just one thing. Go ahead and come on up, Sam. I do want to read just one thing. In the preface of our basic text, it says, and it is here that true love, which is of God, and makes it possible for one person to touch the soul of another person is found and expressed. And I found that in here with you guys. I forgot that, and I had wanted to read that. They hide it up in the front before the numbered pages. Thanks.